Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Supernatural George. I'm Mittens, and today we're going to be discussing Season 7, Episode 23, Survival of the Fittest. Our first 23rd episode of any season, written by Sarah Gamble and directed by Robert Singer. We have finally arrived at the end of Season 7. Could have dragged on forever. But it didn't. It did end. It's also the end of Gamble era, and we're going out by boning dick. We've got a lot to cover, from Cass's current mental state of abject denial and avoidance, Bobby's ghost having just gone as close to full vengeful as he can get without being lost forever to it, Kevin in the hands of the Leviathan, Dean struggling under the weight of most of a season of suspending himself in midair by his own bootstraps as he clings to whatever he has left, and Sam struggle bussing through the fallout of all of that. And it's a lot. And I'm mostly grateful that I will never have to try and say Leviathan anything, because for some reason, every time I try and say it, for the last 22 episodes, I stumble over it. So I'm grateful that we're going to be done with that soon. Reading through my tag for this episode this morning, it's largely about Cass. I've mentioned in previous episodes that this really was a turning point, not just in Cass's narrative arcs, after they attempted to write him out of the show entirely at the beginning of Season 7, and were then forced to bring him back in 7:17, but in how the show itself is constructed around the main characters. As much as we all screamed, "Where's the angel?" for the rest of the series, when Cass wasn't in an episode, it's really for a very good reason after this point. We wonder where he is, because he does become more central to the narrative. Well, aside from the last two episodes of the series, but we're not going to talk about that today, because I am not in the mood for an hour-long rant about it. Let's just try and get ourselves to the doorway of Season 8. So let's just jump right in to all the emotional trauma. And because this is a season finale, we're subjected to a carry-on Wayward Son edition of The Road So Far. At least we also have the gag reel to comfort ourselves with when we're finished, yes? We open with a series of clips from some of their more generic monster hunts of the season, before we move into the bigger plot things of the season, including Dean beheading his Leviathan doppelganger with an axe, and Sam shooting Dean's Amazon daughter. Fun reminders of the season, right? We then move all the way back to Cass failing to contain the Leviathan, being taken over by them, and exploding in that lake. And then we cut to Crowley's first meeting with Dick, and the reminder that Dick would sooner swim through hot garbage than work with Crowley. Dick then shoots Bobby as they try to make their escape, and then Bobby dies and sticks around as a ghost who goes vengeful and possesses a poor hotel maid in last week's episode. We then cut back to 7:17 with Dean finding Emmanuel, aka Cass, and Meg showing up just in time to gank a demon about to kill Dean. We're introduced to Kevin and his advanced placement prophet awakening, and the magical tablet inscribed with the word of God that only he can read, which gets him kidnapped by the Leviathans. We then cut to Bobby explaining the only way to kill Leviathans is with a weapon made from the, quote, three bloods of the fallen, which means a fallen angel, an alpha monster, and the king of hell. So they summon Crowley, who will only give his blood when they have everything else first. We get a nice montage of ghosts flaming out as a convenient reminder of what's about to happen to Bobby, and then various other creatures dying. And then the end of last week's episode. They've got Crowley in their corner, so what could possibly go wrong? Followed immediately by Dick Roman summoning Crowley into a devil's trap. And on that relatively hopeless note, we cut to now, right back inside Dick's office, where he's apparently decided that he's had enough swimming in hot garbage for now and would at least prefer to have a somewhat civil chat with Crowley instead. I appreciate this scene because despite Dick keeping his cool, it's clear that he knows he's in trouble. He still thinks he can solve his pesky little problems, though. Typical CEO behavior, honestly. But Crowley sees right through all of it. He knows how important he is in this situation and is equally good at keeping his cool. He points out that it would be easy for Dick to just have him killed outright, but that Dick hadn't, under the assumption that Crowley would have taken precautions in that event, such as being prepared to have a vial of his own blood automatically sent to the Winchesters if he were to die. And yeah, they point this option out, but ignore the much simpler one. If Crowley died, another demon would then be put in charge of hell, and their blood would then be what the spell needed. We will eventually see the parade of wannabe kings of hell, like really subpar wannabe kings of hell. But for the Leviathan, it would be like playing whack-a-mole trying to find and kill the next ruler of hell. It could be anyone. And Crowley is right there as a known quantity. It's much simpler to just deal with him than it would be to chase down demon after demon, right? Plus, Dick knows Crowley, in that he's proven himself to be honorable in his dealings. When he makes contracts, they're ironclad, and he abides by them. I mean, sure, he wiggles around in technicalities and loopholes, but that's exactly why Roman puts so much time and effort into crafting what he believes is an unbreachable contract. I find this whole thing fascinating, because we know this is the one time that Crowley just tosses his contract in the trash. He throws everything in on the Winchesters. He's betting everything that they will actually succeed in their insane plan. And I think that says so much about Crowley himself, and also what he knows and believes about Sam and Dean. So while Crowley kills a heck of a lot of time in nitty-gritty negotiations with Dick over his comically long scroll that would grant demons free reign in Canada and nowhere else, he's also giving Sam and Dean what he hopes is enough time for them to assemble the rest of the ingredients they need to actually send Dick back to Purgatory forever. And I mean, Cass may have been the one to actually do the deed that pulled the Leviathan here in the first place, but the plan Cass was working off had been Crowley's to start with. And Crowley might seem cocky, but it was his idea that oopsied the Leviathans into the world. And I think on some level, Crowley has to know that if the plan had worked out the way he'd intended, it could have just as easily been him the Leviathans walked into that lake and exploded. But Crowley's doing what he has to clean up his mess, as much as Cass is, you know? And then we cut to the title card. Post-title card, we join Sam and Dean driving to search for the bone of a righteous mortal. Apparently, they'd been scratching their heads about it for a while, and out of desperation, based on a bad joke suggestion of Dean's, they're committed to their current plan. When Dean complains about it, Sam says they could try calling Castiel again, and we get the classic line about Cass and bees from Dean, in complete exasperation, relating the incident where Cass showed up naked and covered in bees. Did Cass literally appear on the car? Or, as some folks believe, was Dean simply swearing on his car, the way someone might say, "On my mother's life, this is the truth," for emphasis? Either way, this line has inspired so many scenes in fanfic and fan art. So many Cass costumes. I've seen people full cosplay just covered in bees. And my personal obsession for bee tattoos so that I too can someday be naked and covered in bees. Unfortunately, tattoos are expensive, and while I have a large number of tattoos, I've only managed to get 2 bees so far, so I really need to get back on that now that the world isn't shut down for COVID anymore. So yeah, either way, Sam is really relieved he hadn't been there for the naked bees event. Dean switches the radio on, and Disappointingly, it's a talk radio dude talking about Dick Roman and SucroCorp stock. What Sam and Dean do learn from this is that Dick's hanging out at SucroCorp headquarters. At least they know where they can find him when their weapon is ready. Meanwhile, the maid possessed by Bobby's ghost wanders past a TV shop that's also playing news about Dick at SucroCorp. When we return to Dick's office late that night, it's to find them still working through the tedious details of Crowley's contract. And Sam and Dean have arrived at their destination, the burial crypt at a convent. They're looking for the bone of a righteous mortal, and a nun really isn't a terrible place to start that search. They discard several options, including a woman who died young and didn't really have enough life experience, even if she was a good person. They dismiss the previous head of the convent because she must have been too political. Might be controversy there. When Sam finally finds a nun who lived 83 unremarkable years of quiet, nun-like contemplation, and they smash open her grave. The next morning, Dick and Crowley are still editing their contract, while back at the Winchester's cabin, they're also trying to summon Crowley now that they have all their other ingredients. They're kind of confused when Crowley doesn't show up immediately. Dean's convinced that Crowley's screwing them over, and Sam tries to explain it away. Maybe he got held up by something. They're cut off from that argument by a knock on the door. It's Meg. After everything she's been through with Cass, her wanting him for her own personal attack dog and bodyguard, she's completely exasperated with him and has arrived to effectively dump him off on the Winchesters. She'd been in hiding when Cass found her and zapped her right back there. Dean asks the correct question. Why? Why would Cass bring her back? And then just hang out in her car listening to a Don McLean song. Incidentally, a really fucking depressing song, instead of actually going inside with her. Because he's in extreme denial, but his guilt is pushing him to do something. I actually see this as a tiny bit of progress for him. He's not just wandering and running away. Even if he can't bring himself to fully engage yet, at least he's moved on from his previous nature boy appearance with the bees. Dean goes out to talk to him because he was Cass's boyfriend first, as Meg taunts him. And we're not even touching that line other than to point and stare at it. Dean hears Cass is listening to Vincent, and he has to stand up and mentally slap himself to keep his cool. It was just too big of a reminder of how entirely not himself Cass is right now. But Dean asks him, "What's the word?" And so we know Cass knows exactly what this phrase means, which should be all the confirmation we need eventually in 8-8. When he replies to the same question, "It's just a shortened version of my name." In that episode, Cass is clearly trying to make a joke with that line. But that's enough looking to the future for now. Let's get back to this particular conversation. Instead of saying anything useful or relevant, Cass goes on about how practical monkeys are and how shameful it is that people test cosmetics on them. But at least Cass does come inside when Dean invites him, and he prefaces everything by reminding them that he doesn't participate in aggressive activity, so even if he has information for them, he will not be acting on any of it. Cass also picks up the bone that they stole from the nunnery, sniffs it, and knows exactly whose bone it is, and approves of their choice. So I guess that's at least a relief that they interpreted that bit of the spell correctly. When prompted again to tell them why he brought Meg there, Cass tells them that he never heard anything else from the garrison, so he eventually went to look for the other angels at Kevin's house and found them all dead. This might also be the first time that Sam and Dean have learned that the Leviathan can also kill angels, which is unsettling, but also adds even more weight to why Cass might not want to fight them. Angels aren't used to feeling vulnerable like that. But the real shock is that the entire garrison is apparently now dead, or else whoever's left alive is in hiding. Dean's first question is, if the angels are dead, then where is Kevin? And Cass goes right back to talking about monkeys and how he could steal them from their cages to set them free, but then he wouldn't know what else to do with them. Dean claps his hands and tells Cass to focus. Is Kevin alive? And Cass blurts out, I don't want to fight, while unable to meet Dean's eyes. Dean forces himself to calm down and tell Cass they're just worried about Kevin. And Cass says that the Leviathans took him, he's still alive, and then Cass heaves a sigh of relief and begins wandering around again, as if he's completely unburdened with having to deal with it now, because Sam and Dean will deal with it, right? All the while, Meg is noticing the summoning supplies that they've put off to the side and getting a little bit worried about them. Cass really did bring Meg as backup, or as a sort of shield, or maybe even as like a comfort object, while he broke all of this news to Sam and Dean. He says he felt so much responsibility for it all, but Kevin's life is in their hands now. Like, that just freed Cass from any personal responsibility for it. Dean's about to lay into him about how, no, the fuck, this does not absolve Cass of his responsibility, when Meg cuts him off to ask about the summoning stuff. She freaks out and is about to leave when Crowley does finally show up. And this is the first time Crowley is seeing Meg since he last tried to kill her, and his first time seeing that Cass is still alive since Cass betrayed him. And I've always wondered if, even in this moment, Crowley had still been debating whether it was worth abiding by his contract with Dick just to cash in on the prizes in that room. But no, he's way too smart a businessman to double-cross Sam and Dean here. And that's enough said about Crowley's business acumen for now. Meg tries to run, tries to smoke out, and Crowley stops her. When Cass steps in to defend her, Crowley asks him why he isn't dead yet, and offers to help him out with that. When Dean tries to call Crowley off, Crowley lets out a little righteous anger. He wants explanations for why they're harboring the one angel he most wants to crush. Meg sneers at this, like, oh, so you can crush angels now? Practically mocking him. And Crowley replies that Meg has no sense of poetry. Very much like we saw in 721 when she taunted Cass for getting all poetic with her. I just find it an interesting parallel that she doesn't appreciate anyone's poetry, no. Crowley asks Cass very directly what he has to say for himself, and Cass starts babbling about his communication strategy, that he hasn't been back to heaven even, and then he starts rambling about insects and bees and honey and silk and miracles. And Crowley glances at Dean, who just sort of shrugs, and he asks Cass what he's even talking about. Cass says that he prefers insects to angels. Angels can't make honey or silk, even if they technically can make miracles, you know? Everything about Cass's obsession with the orderly hive structure of bees, paralleling it to heaven and angel hierarchy, he recognizes the difference and prefers the version that actually produces something worthwhile, you know? Because that is the difference. It's a commentary on heaven and angels directly, and Cass prefers the messiness of the rest of creation, including humanity, even while he's dodging most of the mess, as much as he possibly can at the moment. He pulls out a baggie full of honey and offers it to Crowley, and Crowley gets it, that Cass is completely batshit bonkers. Crowley picks up a glass of whiskey off the table, takes a sniff, shakes his head at it, and Dean asks if Crowley's just there to donkey punch his old grudges or to help them end Dick, that he has to pick a battle. Crowley puts the drink down and agrees that clobbering Cass as he was right then, a ball of wet fur, wouldn't be that much fun. He can wait on that. and instead pulls out a vial of blood. Sam's suspicious about why Crowley had the vial all ready to go, and why it took him so long to get there, and Crowley tells them flat out that Dick had him in a devil's trap. He explains Dick's deal, but tells Sam it really is his blood. Dean asks why they should trust him, and Crowley tells him that they shouldn't. They should never trust anyone. He's looking directly at Cass as he says this, because his last business partner screwed him over. Crowley's little speech before he hands over the blood is fascinating to me, though. He warns Meg that he also intends to scoop her up and roast her until she's jerky. When Cass starts to move on Crowley, he adds, "But not yet." He knows Cass would be upset about losing her, and Sam and Dean need Cass to get Dick. Crowley looks very pointedly at Cass, and Cass tries to dodge all responsibility with, "Oh, I don't fight anymore." Crowley just doubles down, telling Cass that, sadly, he's vital to them being able to kill Dick. Crowley tosses the vial of blood to Dean and disappears, without explaining what he means, which probably would have been useful and saved them a lot of hassle. Out on the street, Bobby's still possessing that poor maid. She's carrying a newspaper and something wrapped up in paper. She tries to open the door of a truck and then reaches into the bed for something and touches a bar made of pure iron, forcing Bobby's ghost out of her. She begs him to stay away from her, to let her go, and he almost takes pity on her until he sees the newspaper she dropped with Dick's photo printed on it. And he goes vengeful enough not to care about her anymore and takes her over again because he needs her. Back at SucroCorp headquarters, Dick's talking with Susan, his assistant. He knows there's a chance that Crowley will try to screw him over, even with their supposedly airtight contract. He's got a backup plan, and he sends Susan to fetch an arm out of the freezer. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the building, Kevin's trapped in a conference room. Someone brings a young woman in and orders her to sit, like she was a dog. Kevin tries to talk with her, but she's eating Twizzlers that are probably laced with the bad corn syrup, and is just as vacant as most of the population we've seen in the last few episodes. And Kevin knows he's still on his own. Back at the cabin, Sam and Dean mix up the spell ingredients, lamenting that they will only get one shot at this. They're not sure if Crowley would want Dick or them dead more, but they don't have much of a choice other than to just go with the only plan that they have. Sam pours the blood mixture over the bone, and once again, I need to ask why they would pour it over the knobbly handle end of the bone and not the pointy stabby end. Like every other special weapon on this show, you put the spell over the part you stab with, not the handle. I guess it doesn't really matter if it transforms the entire bone into a magical weapon, but still, it seems unsanitary at best here. Pouring the blood over the part you need to hold in your hand, you know? But nothing happens. No smoke, no sparkles, no thunder, no glowy woo-woo. And again, they just have to trust that it actually worked. But while they're worrying about that, Cass appears and startles Dean with a hand slapped on his shoulder. He'd been away in Normandy, assembling them sandwiches entirely free of Leviathan tampering to keep up their strength, which probably by this point Dean actually appreciates, you know, just having a decent sandwich to eat. He even thanks Cass as he takes his plate, but Sam doesn't. He only asks why Crowley was so certain that Cass needed to go with them. Cass again can't look them directly in the eye when he says that Crowley was wrong, that Cass will just be waiting right there. The sandwiches were the only solidarity he was capable of offering at that moment. The next day at SucroCorp, Dick's frozen arm arrives. It belonged to the real Dick Roman, and the Leviathan admires the watch that's still around his wrist. He's getting ready for some sort of big meeting as we cut to Kevin and Polly still chilling in their conference room. The same Leviathan guy brings in a garment bag of clothes and orders Polly to get dressed. While she begins to comply without objection, Kevin notices a bunch of hairpins included in Polly's outfit. Dick and Susan head outside to greet a line of limos delivering people for their meeting. And back in the conference room, the Leviathan guy comes back again to collect Polly and deliver a burger and fries to Kevin. Kevin tells him that he's a vegan, can't eat this. And Leviathan just rolls his eyes. And just as oddly as she'd arrived in Kevin's life, Polly is gone again. As soon as they're gone, Kevin pulls out the hairpin he stole and tries to pick the lock. At Dick's meeting, we see a shot of a folder labeled Gas and Sip, which I appreciate as one of the few arms of Richard Roman Enterprises that actually survives his downfall. From what Dick says, it's clear that everyone around this table is a Leviathan, the most high-ranking Leviathans. They're eating orphan sushi and talking about the humane, efficient slaughterhouses they've been building. Meanwhile, Kevin is in the hallway listening to all of that. Dick puts up a map of the U.S., divided up into large sections, labeled labor, livestock, and testing, with Ohio marked out for beta testing, Wisconsin marked for processing, which we know means the slaughterhouses being built there, and Florida singled out for breeding. Kevin has heard enough and makes a run for the nearest exit, but he's caught out by Susan. Dick then introduces a compliant and doped-up Polly to the assembled Leviathans. She'd just been sitting in the corner listening to his entire presentation and has zero self-protection instinct left. Meanwhile, outside SucroCorp, Sam and Dean have arrived. Sam uses Charlie's software hacks to tap into the surveillance cameras inside the building, and they almost immediately see the problem. Dick's supposedly in the conference room, but he's also in his office, and also wandering all over the building. There's too many Dicks. And of course, this is why he needed the frozen arm to have a bunch of otherwise disposable copies of himself walking around. He knows the Winchesters might have a single-use weapon out there, and he's doing everything in his power to make it completely useless. And of course, this is also why Crowley was convinced that Cass would be essential to them. We've already been reminded that all these Leviathan were last in the same room, inside that particular angel. So that angel is the only one who can actually tell them all apart. In the conference room, Dick's talking about having wiped out three different types of cancers, and Polly is too stoned to notice or care. He orders her to take off her dress, and she just does, while Dick points out how slim she is. They're not breeding art, but meat. And he's found a way to breed out people like Polly with fast metabolisms and slim bodies. The Leviathan guarding her pulls out a syringe and injects it into her arm while Dick explains what it is. A quicker acting version of a drug that they're shipping out. And within moments, Polly begins convulsing, drops to the ground, and dies. All while Dick casually explains all the population groups that this particular additive will weed out. Thin people, short people, hemophiliacs, and intelligent people. He only wants the dumbest, fattest people to survive. Best for eating. They're adding this chemical to creamer and vitamins and shipping it out to Los Angeles beginning the next day. They expect the symptoms to prompt reports of a dysentery outbreak. And I don't know, the way Polly died, it didn't look anything like dysentery to me. While Dean and Sam are still sitting outside trying to figure out what to do about their multiple Dicks, a pickup truck pulls up outside and our intrepid and slightly possessed hotel maid gets out. And Sam thankfully recognizes her from the motel when they inadvertently bumped into her in the previous episode, and realize what happened to Bobby. Sam tells Dean to wait there. He's got to stop Bobby. While Dean protests, Sam runs off to tackle the maid before Bobby blows their entire operation. Sam tries to talk sense to Bobby, warns him about all the cameras, that he's going to get that maid killed, and Bobby just shoves Sam out of his way. Sam gets up and points that Bobby can't kill Dick, so what's he even trying to do? And Bobby pulls out a huge knife and takes a swipe at Sam with it. Sam tries to physically restrain Bobby from going in there, and Bobby slams him up against the side of a van and starts choking him. As Sam begs him to stop and slowly succumbs to being choked, sliding down the van, Bobby gets a glimpse of his own reflection in the shiny side of the van, and it's luckily just enough to break through to him in a strange iteration of a crypt scene. I suppose I should define what that is. A crypt scene is shorthand we've been using for years for any scene like this where a character reaches through possession or other outside control to break another character free of it, like Dean does with Cass in 817 in the literal crypt, and in numerous other scenes in the series, but it relies on the prior relationship and personal care for one another between the two characters to actually work. And of course, Bobby thinks of Sam as his own kid, you know? So, just as it did here, when Bobby breaks free and lets the maid go. Sam picks her up and carries her to safety, but it's kind of screwed over their plans to go after Dick. Back at the cabin, Dean's left staring at Bobby's flask. Like, they're just waiting for Bobby to show up again. Kind of terrified of what might come back of Bobby, you know? The maid's going to be fine, though. She's in the hospital, but she's about to be released. And Cass has made more solidarity sandwiches in lieu of doing anything truly helpful. At least he's sticking around. Meg is, too. And she's mostly pissed that Sam and Dean were literally right there and didn't even try to go after Dick. Sam just blurts out that Dick made more dicks. And everyone, including Cass, just kind of stares at him. Cass looks super shifty about this as Sam explains that they have no idea how to tell the real Dick from all the fake ones. Dean then literally calls Cass shifty, asking what his problem is, and rather than answer, Cass just asks if they need a cat. Dean asks if he has anything to say on the topic of dicks, since Crowley was sure that Cass could help them with this, and Cass again adamantly says that no, he can't help. But at least this time he goes into a little more detail, and even manages to talk about himself in the first person. He says he destroyed everything, and if he helps them now, he will destroy everything again. And he just wants to drop the subject. But Dean refuses. He knows that Cass knows exactly what he did, that he's the reason Leviathan are out at all. And Dean snaps. Interestingly, while reviewing my notes for this episode, I realize this may be one of the more frequently asked questions I've answered over the years, like at least a few times in my notes, about isn't it awful how Dean talks to Cass here? How dare he, right? Well, he's been pussyfooting around Cass pretty much since he's been back. He's been wearing kid gloves around him, trying not to upset him, while Dean's had to spend the entire season scrambling to clean up other people's messes and getting zero reprieve from it. He's been told all season to paste on a smile and act professional and keep doing the thing anyway. He's been told by Bobby to pull himself together and stop talking like one of the dead hunters. He'd been called a Nancy by Elliot Ness even. Nobody cared that Dean was broken either. And he just can't take watching Cass succumb to the same bullshit that almost got him several times earlier this season, you know? And Dean gives Cass the literal only advice that he himself has been given all season. Nobody cares that you're broken. Just clean up your mess. Cass puts down the dish that he was cleaning and walks over to Dean as if he's about to have something to say after all. But he retreats right back into his helpless act and just suggests that they should play Twister instead, and then vanishes. I do appreciate the framing in a lot of the shots of Cass in this episode, where he's standing in front of the deer antlers hanging on the wall so that it looks like he's got antlers. This is not commentary on that, it's just I'm pointing it out that it happens a lot in this episode. Anyway, Meg takes a jab at Dean for scaring off their only hope, because all the Leviathan were inside Cass once. Of course he's the only one who can see past their meat suits and spot the real Dick. But Cass isn't really in a state to actually be useful to them, as he reappears on a Twister mat, all twisted up, and spinning the spinner for his next move. Later that night, Dean's looking at the security footage, realizing it's impossible to tell any of the Dick clones apart. Even their mannerisms have all been downloaded from the original Dick. The only thing that Sam can come up with is maybe trying to figure out what the real Dick would be doing and try and pinpoint him that way. And that's when Bobby finally shows back up, just in time to call them all idiots. Sam wasn't sure if he'd be back at all, and Bobby again calls them dumb since they have his flask. Of course he'd be back. Where else would he go? He tells them that they should have burned the flask already, like as soon as he went vengeful. But Sam is wary. I mean, the last time he saw Bobby, Bobby tried to kill him. And Bobby confesses he still wants to go back to possess somebody and just run headlong at Dick. Which is probably super not comforting to Sam and Dean as the two closest possible bodies that Bobby could possess. From across the room, Bobby slams the laptop shut that's been playing video of Dick Roman when it nearly drives him vengeful again. He doesn't want to go vengeful. But they all know how serious this moment is. Bobby's on the verge of tears, talking about how he nearly killed Sam and that woman. Even Sam makes excuses for him. It wasn't really Bobby doing that. Bobby kind of laments some of his choices now, thinking that he could outsmart what naturally happens to all ghosts eventually. And Dean asks him what it feels like to go vengeful. Bobby says it's like an itch that you can't scratch. He tells them to go get Dick, but not because they think it'll scratch that itch, but just because it's the job. It's what they need to do. He also tells them that when their time comes, to go, not to try to stick around like he did. So they start a fire and stand there feeling their feelings as Bobby gives them a final farewell. Dean tosses the flask in the fire, and Bobby is set free. We see the flask melt, but only the glow of Bobby disappearing reflected on Sam and Dean's mournful faces before the camera pans over to show Cass sitting quietly in the shadows on the stairs, watching over them all and feeling all of his feelings about it too. Later, Cass is setting up yet another board game, Uno this time, when Dean approaches and asks for a wingman. Cass tries to protest and Dean explains. He gets that Cass doesn't want to jump into the jaws of death, but he needs his help running an errand. Dean voluntarily asks Cass to zap them to the barn where Frank had stowed the Impala all season. And that simple act of asking Cass to fly him somewhere when we all know how much Dean hates getting zapped around by angels shows a lot of trust being put in Cass. He's trying to extend an olive branch here. Meanwhile, in reality, the Impala had actually spent the entire season getting an engine transplant and a complete refurbishment. So the whole driving montage we're getting in a few minutes here really feels triumphant for so many reasons, Yes, Dean is getting his car back finally. They're using it to make a major statement about their control over the narrative here. But also just, you know, they're celebrating the car having been restored to its full glory here. Just the crew of the show who did it. Dean thanks Cass for the lift, and Cass starts to reply, but Dean cuts him off saying, "Yes, I get it. I'm not trying to force you to help beyond this." But Cass has a few questions of his own, clarifying the plan that they're about to embark on. He understands the consequences that if their plan fails, that Sam and Dean would die heroically. But the magical bit is Cass including himself in this plan. The we. If he goes too, then at least he'll die trying to fix his own mistake. Or maybe he won't die. Or maybe he'll be resurrected again. And he sees all of those past resurrections now as punishments, because things seem to get worse for him every time he's brought back. And I wonder if that's not just commentary from Cass about what he's been through, but even just a tiny bit of commentary from Sarah Gamble as she exits the show after a mostly less than stellar run. How much of a punishment to her personally was it to have to bring Cass back, you know? Anyway, that's all idle speculation, but I'm the kind of person who enjoys pointing it out anyway. Dean tries to parse out that whole statement. So we're talking about God crap, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, God crap in the sense that the writer is God. And Cass at least brings it back on topic, flat out saying that he's not good luck. Dean tries to pep talk him about it. He'd rather have Cass cursed or not. Because, for fuck's sake, hasn't that been Dean's entire shtick since the pilot episode of this series? That their whole family is cursed, but especially him? So yeah, if anyone was gonna get it, Dean's gonna get that sentiment. Cass begins smiling just a little, and not the creepy smile of the absolutely deranged he's had occasionally over the last few episodes. He detects a note of forgiveness from Dean, and Dean shrugs it off, but yeah, we're probably gonna die tomorrow, so yeah, I'll forgive you. Which harks back to Rufus's death in season 6, where Dean told Sam and Bobby that at the end of the day, they've got blanket forgiveness for everything. There's no use carrying baggage like that to the grave. And now, Cass has been lumped into that forgiveness. This is truly step one for Cass in beginning to reclaim himself from the guilt and depression he's been running from. Cass tells Dean that if all of that is true, then Cass will go with him and he'll do his best. So he wants to know the plan. And this really is the resolution of Dean's painful betrayal by Cass that he's been struggling with since the end of season 6. This is Cass finally taking the action that Dean had been waiting for all along, which was just to be there with him. Cass doesn't have to be perfect. He doesn't have to be the savior. He just has to be willing to stand beside Dean as they take on the insurmountable odds. We're better together and all that. Dean tells him that Dick knows they're coming anyway, so there's no sneaking in covertly. Why not announce their arrival? And we cut to the beautiful driving shot montage of Baby while Born to be Wild blasts. It's kind of maddening because in some of those shots, we can clearly make out Sam and Dean in the car as it zooms past the security checkpoint at SucroCorp before it goes smashing through the big sign. Only it's not Sam and Dean who step out when security closes in on them at gunpoint. It's Meg. Security guards shoot out one of the car's windows, and oh my god, my heart was breaking the first time I saw that. Like, they just fixed it. They just spent all year working on this car, and now they shoot out a window. They hit Meg a few times, but she's a demon, so she just keeps right on walking. While she's outside distracting everyone, Sam, Dean, and Cass sneak into the building. Outside, Meg's armed with borax and takes care of the guards, while Sam sneaks around looking for Kevin, and Dean and Cass go after Dick. The first Dick they find is an imposter, though. When Meg strolls away, having taken out all the guards, she's met by a couple of demons there to collect her for Crowley. Meanwhile, Sam has found Kevin and is trying to get him to leave, but Kevin refuses until they destroy Dick's lab full of poisoned creamer that will kill all the skinny people. Dick just happens to be in that lab praising the scientist Leviathan who came up with the creamer idea when he hears a sickening thud and turns around to find that scientist headless on the ground with Dean and Cass standing over his body. Dick seems stupidly unfazed by this. When Dean pulls out the bone, Dick compliments him on actually putting it all together, and Dean taunts him that Dick doesn't think it'll work. Dick taunts back that Dean isn't even sure that he's the real Dick, and Dean agrees, but he is confident that Cass knows it's really him. And Dean, in a life or death moment, unequivocally declares his absolute faith in Cass. Yay. Finally. This is like the biggest sign that their relationship is on the mend. Cass is busy engaged in a glare-off with Dick, while Dean explains that Crowley will always find a way to bone you. And if that ain't season 10 foreshadowing, woe betide us for the Dean and Crowley summer of love. Anyway, Dick is done with them, though. He declares their meeting over and tries to leave. Cass pushes past Dean, and Dick just flings Cass dramatically across the room into a bunch of glass-filled boxes for maximum smashing effect. Dean takes the opportunity to stab Dick in the chest with his bone, but it doesn't do anything. Dick just pulls it out and thinks he's won. He snaps the bone in half and gloats. Did Dean really think that would work? And Dean says, honestly, no, as he pulls out yet another bone, and Cass sneaks up behind Dick to hold him still while Dean rams the second bone through Dick's neck. Dean figured they'd have to catch him off guard. And this time, it really does work. Plus, we get one of my favorite screen caps of the entire series, the look on Cass's face as he holds Dick still. He looks like a rabid chipmunk, and it's incredible. Anyway, if you can get it to pause at just the right moment, you can see it. If not, there's screenshots of it all over Tumblr. Anyway, Dick's gargling on that bone just in time for Sam and Kevin to come running in. Dick's looking practically giddy as waves of energy begin pulsing out of him until he explodes in a blast of black goo. For the life of me, I have no idea why Dean and Cass, and Sam and Kevin for that matter, even if they were outside the major blast radius, but why the hell did they just stand there? Why didn't they run for it? Anyway, they didn't run for it. And when the explosion's done, only Sam and Kevin are still standing there. Kevin really thinks they should get the hell out of there before any more Leviathans show up, but Sam is too stunned. He's looking around for Dean and Cass, but there's no sign of them. And Crowley appears, assuring Sam and Kevin that his demons have begun picking off the rest of the Leviathan. Either they're all just killable now that Dick's been boned, or they're getting sucked back to purgatory one by one anyway. Either way, whichever headcanon you prefer, the Leviathans will no longer be a problem on Earth for the rest of the series, at least. So hooray for that, I guess. Sam asks where Dean is, and Crowley tells him that God weapons often have these kinds of side effects, which we've seen over and over again in this series. Every time they get a god-level weapon in the entire series, it's either got a loophole or God's just made up stupid rules for how they work. Nothing is ever straightforward when dealing with Chuck's little plot devices, is it? I mean, think about the stupid equalizer gun in 1420. He makes it up on the spot and gives it a loophole so big it shouldn't even be worth considering using it, and yet they hang on to it as if they actually might. It's irritating, because Chuck could just wave a hand and fix everything, but he never would. He enjoys watching his creations suffer too much to ever just let them have a real, true, loophole-free win. Anyway, that's a complaint to deal with another day. Right now, Sam is demanding to know where Dean and Cass are, and Crowley just tells him that he can't help him. Crowley snaps his fingers, and a couple demons appear to take Kevin. He snaps again, and Kevin disappears. When Sam looks horrified by this, Crowley tells him that Sam got exactly what he wanted. Dick's dead. The world is safe, and Crowley needed a prophet, so poor Sam is well and truly on his own now. I really don't think that's actually what Sam wanted at all. But he has no idea what happened to Dean and Cass, and what to do next, even. But we do, because after Sam's left standing in that lab all by his lonesome, we flash to Dean waking up on a dark forest floor. Dean asks Cass where they are, and Cass is surprised that Dean doesn't know. Cass had apparently been standing guard over Dean until he became conscious again, and all of a sudden Cass seems pretty much back to normal. The last thing that Dean remembered was ganking Dick. And Cass asked him where Dick would go in the event of his death. Dean figures it out. Purgatory. Where Cass tells him that monsters go to prey on each other for all of eternity. Dean wants to know how the hell they get out of there. Cass tells him that they're much more likely to be ripped to shreds. Dean turns to glance at some snarling, red-eyed creatures closing in on them from the woods, and when he turns back, Cass is gone, and Dean is alone with the monsters. And that's how the episode, and the season, and Gamble Era ends. Thank heck we don't have to wait 4 months to see what happens next, right? Because this was my first hiatus I experienced live. I can't tell you how grateful I am to just be able to zip on to season 8 next week. If that's too long to wait, you can enjoy a few special features on the DVD if you have it. One is an interactive series of short films based on various episodes of season 7 and some of the monsters they introduced. My ancient Blu-ray player does not play well with these sorts of interactive features, so I didn't even attempt to watch them. There's also a commentary track for this episode with Sarah Gamble as her sort of farewell to the show. And of course, we do have the gag reel, which is always fun. While it's been a long time since I watched those monster featurettes, I do know that the gorilla wolves that we see lurking in Purgatory's forest in that final scene were originally created as a potential concept art for the Leviathans, before they went instead with the giant horrible mouths concept. Overall, that was probably easier on the VFX team, even if it's a little disappointing as a viewer. But there we have it. Welcome to Carver Era. Sam thinks he's well and truly alone, with zero idea where to even begin looking for Dean and Cass. For all he knows, they died in that blast. He has an excellent idea where to start looking for Kevin, but instead of doing that, he just turns tail and runs from his entire life, as he is wont to do. File that under one of those things that I will really never forgive Sam for, but we'll get into that next season when Dean judges him hard for that choice. Not only has Dean been bootstrapping himself for the last 2 seasons, dragging Sam along the entire time, he's going to spend a year in purgatory trying to find and save Cass before going home, because surely Sam is capable of taking care of himself for a little while, right? Uh-huh. And Dean is getting a whole year in purgatory to work out all his feelings. Macass is still sort of running from his, even while he tries to help keep Dean safe by keeping him completely in the dark. But again, that's all for next season. For right now, we've got a neat little gooey bow tied on everything from Gamble Era, right? Well, mostly. Good enough that we'll be able to deal with the emotional fallout from it for the rest of the series, more like. Anyway, on that note, join me next week as we dive into Season 8, Episode 1. We need to talk about Kevin because, hell yeah, we really do, Sam. Welcome to Marshmallow Era. Until then, you can find me on Tumblr as MittensMorgul or at SPNGeorge. You can find me on Discord and Blue Sky as MittensMorgul, or you can email me at mittensmorgul@gmail.com. And I look forward to talking to everybody again real soon. I realized I kind of just raced through the ending there and the summary and didn't really talk about Dean and Cass and what this all means for their relationship, but I mean, progress, right? So we'll take it. There's tons of stuff you can read about it on my blog. It's all there. What do I even mean by Marshmallow Era? I realize I should probably explain that one, but Jeremy Carver once described himself in an interview using that term, marshmallow. And it kind of stuck because marshmallows are sticky, unfortunately. And Lizbob, for one, Elizabeth Roberta Jones on Tumblr, made that her tag for everything Carver era, Marshmallow era. So if you want to go look up posts about it, I tried to find the original inciting post where Carver's interview was posted and we adopted that name for him. But I couldn't, and I wasn't about to spend the rest of the night trying to find it. So if anyone does find it, let me know. Otherwise, I'll see y'all in Marshmallow Era. For some reason, I kind of just really want some s'mores now. Anyway, have a good one, everyone.